Greetings. This is James Gillen on the As You Wish Talk Radio on the BBS News Network. And we've got a great show coming up. I've got a few announcements I need to make first. We've got, first of all, give thanks to everyone who assisted the East Eddy community member, Mona. She's grateful to everyone who reached out to support her and save her home. So anyway, I'm sure it was a tear-jerking moment for her when she got the help that she needed. And here's what's coming up next weekend, Friday, July 28th. I'll be part of the UFO Fest in Yelm, Washington. And there's a great lineup of speakers. I'll be speaking and then doing a Skywatch on Friday night before returning to the ranch on Saturday for the Skywatch weekend. Go to eastedyevents.com for the link to the Yelm event, and you can find out about all the different speakers there. The list keeps growing. The weekend of August 3rd, we're continuing building the Earth Dome, the Divine Feminine Meditation Structure, and we'll begin constructing the platforms for the new treehouse accommodations as well. So if you're interested in learning how to build these structures and enjoy the Stargate at East Eddy, at the same time, go to, again, to eastedyevents.com to register. And some of you have mentioned that you can't get out to the ranch but like to support East Eddy's expansion. So here's the link of our GoFundMe account on the eastedyevents.com website. So these structures, you know, take materials and money to put them together. Although we do love the help and the labor, and we also have to buy the materials. And then August 10th through the 13th, we've got Shannon Leichner, who returns to do another Theta Healing workshop, and you can sign up and learn more. Learn for your personal use, or stay an extra day and get certified as a Theta Healing practitioner. And again, go to the same place, eastedyevents.com, to find out more about that. And we've got quite a few things coming up. There's a lot of events happening here. I just got news from, I can't say who, but let's say we've been working with the Golden Dragon and the signatory for the gold, and it looks like things were finally signed off completely. It's stamped, signed, sealed, delivered, so it'll be a little admin time before everybody can go down and cash in their Zims and whatever else they're doing, you know, dinars and everything else. So it looks like that is going to be a go. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of hard work went into this. A lot of people actually gave their lives for this. It's going to be the big shift. This is the turning point right now. That's going to be turning the planet around and making funds available for, you know, the people that are really here to change the planet, and has taken the money and the funds away from those who have been trying to destroy the planet. So it's a major day in Earth's history. I want to get to our guest right here. We've got Alec Newald, and he's an interesting fellow here. He's what's taken for 10 days to an extraterrestrial civilization. And one Monday in mid-February 1989, he set off on what would have been a three-hour drive from, I don't know, I'm going to say this, but it looks like to Auckland in New Zealand. He arrived in Auckland feeling tired and confused, was even more confused to learn that Monday was now Thursday 10 days later, and that he had no idea of what happened in the meantime. When Alex did retrieve his memories of those missing 10 days, he realized his life had changed forever. Early on that fateful trip, while driving through a foggy mountain pass, Alex was whisked from the road by beings from an extraterrestrial civilization. What he learned and experienced during his stay with these friendly beings has profound implications for all of us here on Earth. So without any further ado, I want to bring Alec on the show. Alec, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here, James. Thanks for having me, too, by the way. I really appreciate it.
And also, too, I wanted to mention that you wrote the book Co-Evolution. And is that available on your website?
It's available through Nexus Magazine. Duncan Rose at Nexus Magazine has supported me right from day one. This is going back over 20 years now. And he published the first and second editions of my experience. So I would sort of recommend people get on the Nexus Magazine website and they can hunt the book down from there. We do actually have a third edition, though, I'm working on right now because of my age, which is not getting any younger by the day. We decided there was a lot of private stuff I'd held back because it just impacts so much on your private life. when you, you know, when you're trying to explain this sort of an experience to the general public, and you go out there and you put your name to, I mean, you know, I've always published everything under my own name. I've not hidden behind a nom-de-plume or whatever. You just have to hold back some stuff because people, I don't know, they almost attack you for telling the truth, or you certainly get ostracized and you know, so over the years I've been slightly conservative in the way I published my story. But this third edition will be the final account, and I'm calling in everything that happened, the stuff that is really personal that I'd tried to skip and sidestep around. So I would recommend, if anybody is interested in the story, really maybe hold off for a few months until I get this final edition finalized, and look to Nexus for, you know, the declaration of when we're going to publish it. It really is an eye opener, and it will blow a lot of people away. But as we'll talk about that stuff as we get into it now, James, anyway.
Great.
But
awesome.
Yeah, even though it's available at Nexus, I just would recommend they hold off for a little bit.
Yeah, that's great. It's funny. I just had this conversation with this friend of mine that he's like the signatory, you know, for the moving the gold and things like that. It's amazing. We were talking about that. We said, you know, I said, you know, we should write a book about this or even make a movie about it, but nobody would believe it because it's so outrageous. You know, the intrigue and the, you know, the moles, and it, you know, it goes into interdimensional things and reptilians and serpent beings and demonic stuff and Satan worshiping. And it's just like, I mean, it's so crazy, you know, when you look at what's been going down and all the work that's gone into this and cleaning up all this energy, you know, people just would be shocked. I don't know if they'd even be ready for this or if they could even handle it.
Well, that's part of my problem. This story started almost 30 years ago, James. I think you'd be the first to admit 30 years ago, you know, the human race was pretty much bogged down in the mire of what you call a three-dimensional reality. I think huge things have happened in the last two decades. We sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel, I think. And these stories that you just mentioned there, the dark background, you know, the shadow beings that are sort of controlling or have been controlling, they're starting to, I think, you know, their suspension bridge is starting to fall down, and it's good to be part of it, you know, and people like yourself and Duncan Rose at Nexus, you know, like, they've really been hammering away at that door for a very, very long time, and people like me and my experiences have been really not overlooked, but they've been, because it's impossible for the average person to comprehend, they just have to gloss over. They just go all glazed in the eyes, you know, and it's just too encompassing for them, or too threatening, I think, for them. It was two decades ago anyway, James. But, you know, like the work you're doing there, like out on the ranch and that, and like even like Stephen Greer's stuff, even though everybody's got their enemies and everybody's got their, you know, detractors, but everybody's just chipping away at that stone wall. And I think that there must be a time very, very soon when you can talk about this stuff and people will look at you with an understanding in their eyes instead of that glazed look.
Yeah.
So, I thank you and the people like you for, you know, like, that takes a great deal of energy. I know it's a huge monumental task, what you're doing nonstop, like 24/7, chipping away at the stuff. And whatever you do, and, you know, with your radio broadcasts and your tours and your lectures and the ranch itself, you know, it's just hats off to you. It's actually exhausting. Just trying to keep putting my story out there is exhausting, and I've hidden away. I've hidden from it mostly. I just didn't want the bad press, you know. I just couldn't be bothered with it. So you know, thanks to people like you, maybe now's the time to get out and really open up about this stuff.
Yeah, I think it is, and definitely, you know, kudos to you for all the work you've been doing and coming out, you know, that long ago, and you know, I was I think, well, you know, I think you've had pretty much the same experience. Even as a childhood, I was, you know, having those experiences. And I'd love to hear how that started for you.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about a true story, James. You can't fabricate the detail. You know, like even when like the FBI in America or something investigates a case, it's the forensic stuff that usually hangs someone, if you know what I mean. It's the detail. The devil's in the detail. And if you're making up a story, you can't add that detail and make it fit. And my story's riddled with those minor details, but people just look at the big overall context of what I'm trying to say and they say, oh, you know, that's totally unbelievable. I can't go there, can't absorb that. They never take the time to examine the detail. And if I can open up with, as you were saying, that childhood stuff, and just expand a little bit on the periphery of that childhood experience, I can introduce you to some of the detail that's been overlooked. I was brought up with my parents in a little town south of Auckland, about 20 miles south of Auckland. It's still a quiet little estuary town on a mudflat harbour called the Manukau Harbour in New Zealand. And it was a quiet little place. And you just wonder, because that the situation, the location is vital to my whole story. And you wonder sometimes, you know, did my parents choose that place of their own volition? Or were they guided there in some way? You know, was my life already planned out by some greater scheme? I don't know. You know, are all our lives for a greater good in some way? But certainly, it sort of started, if you go to the grassroots of it, when I was just starting school. So I was about 5 years of age or six. I used to walk to school those days, you know, unescorted. Kids just, you know, not a care in the world. This is the early 1950s. Just walked to school at five. And I used to walk past a public park in this little town, and it was right next to a church. And the interesting thing about, if you know, people that are listening to your shows will know all about ley lines, the dragon lines, the, you know, the earth, the matrix of the crystal matrix of the earth and the bloodlines, if you like, the pulse of the earth. There's a church at one end of my street and a church at the other end of the street. The streets are sort of a crescent. And right in line with those two churches was this park. So I didn't know it at the time, but I was actually walking a ley line. I was walking a dragon line to school, or intersecting one. And right on this park, on that dragon line, was where just like a lightning strike, it'd be a flash of light would come in that park and would draw my attention to it. And the thing that was happening around me at the time, people say, oh, well, how could you possibly go into a vortex or something without anyone seeing you? Being a kid, you chase seagulls and that, you know, when you're young. And in the park, because this was close to a harbour, an estuary, and there were seagulls in this park, and I used to chase them. And whenever that light in that park would glow, seagulls in the park would freeze. So there was some sort of a time interference pattern set up there where obviously my time wasn't altered, and the beings that came out of that light didn't alter their movement, but everything around me was obviously frozen. So I could only imagine that anybody outside of that perimeter of that vortex was probably, my time was probably at 1,000 or 100,000 times quicker than theirs. So I should imagine that that event happening in that park made me at a later time in my life approach a guy in New Zealand called Bruce Cathy. Bruce Cathy was one of the first guys that worked on the grid system, the harmonic grid system of the planet Earth. Bruce Cathy's just recently passed away, unfortunately, but, you know, I became good friends with him, and he helped me with the major details in my story. And it was him that actually decided, you know, I said, what was very special about this park? You know, and that's when he worked out it was on a ley line, on an intersection of a ley line, and it was a very major one at that. And it had to do, in his terminology with the speed of light, electromagnetically and in our own normal sense. So you do get a time aspect associated with this. Now, the thing that really, really counts here is that Bruce Cathy, when he was investigating the grid system and that of the Earth, he found out there's a lot of events on this planet which were geomagnetic. In other words, there were a time element to the location. In other words, the sun and the moon and the time of the year would have a relevance to if that location was active. And his research even went into the detonation of atomic bombs. This is where we get into the forensics of it, where he proved himself to be correct. He actually, when the French were testing in the South Pacific at the Mururoa Atoll, he and this affected, you know, like there's a lot of peace movements going on, you know, to stop atomic testing. Bruce Cathy, with his harmonic maths, he worked out that atomic weapons were also geomagnetic events, and he said you could only detonate an atomic bomb at a particular time and day in a specific place. And he sent to the New Zealand government a list of dates and times that he said if the French are going to detonate at the Mururoa Atoll, it can only happen on this day or that day of a certain month, and even got it down to within an hour of that day on a certain month. And he sent these calculations to the New Zealand government, and he was proved correct. The French did explode an atomic weapon at the Mururoa Atoll within an hour of his predicted time, at a date and a day. And he got it, and he did it again a second time to prove it was a fluke. And the New Zealand government acknowledged that, sent him back a letter with a date stamp on it and said, yes, we've received your prediction. You were correct. The French did explode an atomic weapon on that day and within that hour of your prediction. Now, you've got big ramifications here, James. I know we're going slightly off the path, but I want people to realize that events on this planet are not just random, and everything is connected. And when you're talking about interdimensional beings and portals being opened, the timing of them is crucial. And they're not always available. You can't just go and to a specific spot on the Earth, even a sacred site, and do a chant or a meditation and expect it to open for you, like Stonehenge and that and these ancient sites. You have to be there at the right time. And why a lot of these places are clocks in their own right, like Stonehenge, I think, is a clock. But it's also a clock for a dimensional portal. So what was going on in Papakura was a portal was opening at a specific time of the year and of a day when I was walking past there, because it happened 3 or 4 times a year. And it would be like almost on the solstices, if you like, if you just need to pluck something out of the air. A specific date and time. So these weren't happening every day. And Bruce Cathy, who I worked with, you know, very closely after that, because I had other missions to perform at later dates, and they all required specific timings at specific locations, which is why I'm going into the detail here to build a foundation for what we'll move on to. So Bruce was right. Specific locations on the Earth are sort of vulnerable, if you like, to being manipulated or being used or being opened at specific times. And he was smart enough to work out what locations were active at what points. And henceforth, atomic weapons are a very inefficient weapon for mass warfare. If you consider that if the Russians ever wanted to bomb America with atomic weapons, they could not target New York and Washington and Los Angeles all at the same time and wipe out all the centers in the U.S. because only one location in any one country on any one day at any one hour is actually vulnerable to an atomic attack. So it makes multi-ballistic missile atomic weapons attacks a fundamental fallacy and a lie. They were never going to be used, you know, even at Hiroshima. You know, when the Americans, you know, when you guys dropped the bombs on the Japanese, the planes were sent off to Hiroshima, and they arrived early because they couldn't afford to be late, and they circled the target for some considerable time. And you'd say, you're in foreign territory, and you've got fighter planes trying to get up to the height of these B-52s or whatever they were, which were flying very high, and they waited and waited and waited before they dropped that bomb. What were they waiting for? You know, you don't do that. When you get to your specific target, you drop your bomb and you run, because these guys are low on fuel as it was, trying to get back to their designated landing point. You don't wait to drop something, and they had to wait. So once again, that those atomic bombs are time-sensitive and location-sensitive. That's the sort of forensic detail that people don't bother to go into in my story. And those sort of things pop up all the way through it. So need a breather. If you want to come in and say something, James, you're welcome.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, they've told me over that it's not, you know, it's like a mute point. The whole, you know, nuclear war threat and things like that, that it's just not going to, you know, not going to happen, because they're monitoring it. They've got massive ships up there. They know where everything is, all the little nuclear weapons. I think even the suitcase weapons they talk about, and I'm sure they're nullifying that, you know. But there's so many things I wanted to cover here, but I want to kind of keep going on in the direction that you're taking it. I know you've had a lot of confrontation. I know you've had the Men in Black and the other guys, whoever, knocking on your door. I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, after the, you know, if we can just side skirt the whole major event, which was in 1989, when I sort of went missing for 10 days. But as soon as I got back, I mean, they were almost waiting for me. So, you know, like, even if ETs have an ability to, you know, keyhole in on what we're doing, there's certainly, there's a if you could call the Men in Black movies some sort of reality, there's definitely a group of covert agencies on that are watching extraterrestrial activity coming and going off our planet. And I think people that are involved in legitimate events are certainly marked after that event in some way. Although, in saying that, my car was taken with me as well. And when I got back from that 10 days away, the car just about fell apart. I mean, we had all sorts of problems with the hydraulics and that, and all the rubber and the hydraulics and the power steering just were melting. So, and there was a little computer printed circuit board on the air fuel mix on that car. And when it was examined forensically, not by me, but by the car manufacturers, that circuit board was completely a mirror image of what it should have been. So whoever put that car back together didn't actually make such a great job of it, or it was put together correctly in a mirror universe, but not in ours. And so that was an interesting fact too, and I think it was from the problems with the car that they really zeroed in on me, and that's when my life got, you know, really interesting, because I tried to sidestep, and they kept, you know, like, I moved several times and didn't tell anybody where I was going, where I was moving to, and they just kept finding me all the time. So and then they really started to put the pressure on, because they really wanted to know what I was up to and what had happened. So. And I'm sort of a private sort of a guy, and I sort of, you know, I obviously just told them to, you know, to move on. And as you know, the powers that be don't accept that sort of philosophy. So, yeah, my life turned into a pretty ragged sort of an event after that. And eventually, you know, when they couldn't get me to cooperate, they set me up they framed me in some sort of a criminal event, we could call it, I suppose, and sent me to jail so they could really work me over properly from that point. But, you know, we can get to that. That's the last bit and what I really wanted to build into the new co-evolution story in our third edition. But if you like, we can get back to what actually happened during those missing 10 days, because I was given a mission there too, and that is basically, as it tracks back to that, geometric sort of placement of devices on the planet to do with the grid system, really. What we did find when I was working with Bruce Cathy, because he was so deeply into the harmonic grid of the planet, is that the information I brought back was that there was actually another covert overlay of that grid pattern of the Earth. And it was being meticulously maintained by a group of extraterrestrials. It was an artificial grid structure, if you like. And Bruce had even had some experience of that too, just doing the fine-tuning investigations that there is some sort of an agency which is, an extraterrestrial agency, which is running some sort of a covert agenda of their own on planet Earth. And I think it's basically to keep us locked down in a way and keep us from expanding and becoming the entities which we used to be or can be in the future. So, and they were doing it in some way with a sort of a grid system, which was like an artificial intelligence, which was Wi-Fi-ing us into submission, if you like. And the mission I had was to try and break that system down by putting, spoilers in place, if you like, to disrupt their own grid system. This is all really new stuff for Coevolution 3, and it just makes a whole broader impact of it. And you could see the people that were interfering with me, the people that locked me up, the people that interrogated me in jail, were working for some negative entities that were running the show on planet Earth. That's all I can say. And the group of extraterrestrials I was working with were trying to break that system down. And they were working on other stuff too, other artificial intelligence of a system that had been left behind on planet Earth that could have been released at any time in the future or any time now. So there's a whole lot of stuff, as you say, going on in the background that people can't get their heads around because they've never been exposed to it. I think, the time is probably about now that we start getting this stuff out there and publishing and trying to reach people that probably would accept this information if they had the right detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And now is the time. I was meditating the other day and I got a very clear message. And, it was like for all the light workers and the star seeds and whoever you want to, whatever label you want to give them. But, they're saying, the time's now. We really need to step up to the plate and, call things as they are and come together and pull this planet out of the muck and the mire. But I think there's some kind of an activation code, whatever you want to call it, that, somebody up there is really pushing the button and turning the dial up, because I'm seeing people just pop wide open everywhere.
Yep. Well, to me, going back to those childhood experiences, it wasn't just the location. And when I walked through that vortex, interestingly enough, what they gave, the beings that came out of this vortex light were just like pixies or fairies, I think. I don't know whether they sort of made themselves look something that would be acceptable for a five-year-old without freaking out a young child, They weren't any bigger than me, and I perfectly accepted them as being friends, Like I even said hello at some stage, I think. And they would always give me... And once again, we go back to this geometric sort of opening of a portal. They gave me a little item to hold. It was a tetrahedron. It had markings on it, but they asked me just to stare into this tetrahedron. And in doing that, I just tumble into this other world of theirs. Where there were other children in here, and we were being taught at a school, even though I was walking terrestrially on my way to school, and this interference pattern came in, and wherever I went, we were being taught something entirely different. Because I know that whenever I went to our terrestrial school, I hated it. I hated every moment of my schooling. I couldn't wait to get out of it. It was sort of like I felt like I was being indoctrinated into something that wasn't good for me. And I've held that belief ever since. I mean, terrestrial education, I think, is a very dangerous thing. And I think that all they're doing is prepping us to be slaves to the system. And even at university level, you've got to be very clever to break out of that and use your mind to expand yourself beyond what they're trying to get you to believe in.
Yeah.
So I was being schooled from that age of five. So, you could sort of kind of tell there was something going to happen later on in my life, which they were trying to prep me for, I guess. So even though you just accept these things as a five-year-old, I just forgot about that stuff in later adult life. I mean, children, you know, they fantasize about all sorts of things. You can't even trust your own childhood memories, I guess, as succinct as they might be. You just can brush them over, and everyday life just beats it out of you. I mean, you don't start talking about that sort of stuff when you're an adult. Oh, you know, when I was a kid, these ETs or these pixies or fairies used to come and pluck me into another dimensional realm. You know, you don't say that if you want to have a conversation with anybody else. I mean, you just get shunned to the corner of the room, and then everybody looks at you sideways, and that's the end of that. So you don't dwell there. But that's not the only thing, James, that was happening. I was having repetitive dreams right through my early childhood, right into teenage years. I was having dreams about an ancient civilization on Earth. I was having dreams about visiting Earth in the days of the dinosaur. But we were coming down from the sky, and we had all sorts of technology, and we were doing geological work and excavating and searching for something. And it was always in volcanic zones around the planet. And these dreams would not just be like one-offs. The same dream would come up like three or four times a year, and it would be for year after year. I just, in the end, these dreams were more real than life. I could not get them out of my head. I still can't. I can still take myself back to a hazy atmosphere. And we were in a sort of a scout craft coming down, and I'm looking up, and there's this huge pyramidal craft floating in the haze above us, and it's so clear. I can see it right now in my mind's eye. And we're on our way back. We're on our way down, and there's a group of us in this craft, and we're looking down, and we see movement. And because we're going into a heavily forested rainforest type area, and there's huge creatures which would be dinosaurs, you know, but for a kid like five or six, I'm seeing these huge things trying to relate who and what they are. And I remember the rhetoric going around on the craft was saying, I thought these things were extinct now, you know, and we could see these. So, you know, we were going to set up camp in these jungles, and we were thinking, hang on, there's the 30-foot bloody giant creatures roaming around down here, and here we are, we're about 4 foot tall. You know, in a fragile state on a planet which had, you know, too much gravity for us probably at that time. And we were out of our safe zone. And I remember we set up camps with all sorts of safety devices and warning things to set off. You know, as a child, you don't have these sort of, you shouldn't be having these sort of memories. That was a wake-up call. That was a reminder that I'd been here before and not as a human, and that, you know, my life had other aspects to it, which, you know, was relevant to what was going to happen in later life. And that these same entities that I was in those dreams were the ones that abducted me for 10 days. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit loath to call it abduction, though, because there's such a thing as ET recovery. And yeah, I think these were my ancestors, truly were my ancestors. And they were coming back to recover me, because obviously at some stage, some deal had been done on a soul level where I would manifest myself in human form on planet Earth. But, you know, but still have this connection to this ancient life, to this other realm, to these other entities, to these other extraterrestrials, and at a set time and place, obviously, that I would be recovered, I would be taken home. But, you know, as you know, when you're born into the human form down here, amnesia is the number one conundrum. You can't remember who you were, what you've done, where you've been, how many lives you've had, or what the hell's going on. You know, it's just, it all starts from scratch. And I had, you know, even in spite of those childhood memories, those persistent dreams, I had no recall of any of this, you know, in my 3D mindset of a Earth human adult at 40 years of age I was then, that I had any of this heritage. So when they did come and pluck me from with car and all off that road going from Rotorua, you got it right, your pronunciation was dead set correct, from Rotorua to Auckland. I was like, what the hell is going on here? You know, like, I actually, when they first come to pluck me out of the car, I was driving the car and I felt like a ton of bricks had landed on me, like someone had poured cement on me. I just felt like I was pushed into the seat of that car and I was paralyzed. I couldn't turn the steering wheel or apply the brakes or do anything. And that car was just barreling along at 60 miles an hour. 100 kilometers an hour, our terminology. And I was on a rocky mountain road, and there was a big cliff face straight ahead of me, and I could not turn that steering wheel. I was frozen into that car. And I thought, ouch, this is going to hurt. You know, I'm going to hit that stone wall at 100 miles an hour, or 60 miles an hour. And I was just waiting for the impact. And there was nothing after that, nothing at all, like blank. And then when I come to, I'm in this huge cavernous space with sort of a flashing blue neon light, and I'm in a non-body form, you know, like I'm a ghost. So what do you think? Naturally, you think, I've just crashed the car and I'm dead. This is some sort of an afterlife. You know, here I am. I can vaguely remember the car charging at this rock wall, and then nothing, and then I'm in this cavernous space with nothing around me, and I'm looking down, and I'm just a wispy ghost there. Like, I've got no form at all, and I'm trying to figure out where the hell am I now, hoping it wasn't hell, and trying to figure out. So the mindset, even at that stage, this is not an extraterrestrial event. I mean, that was the furthest thing from my mind, James. I hadn't studied up on extraterrestrial. I hadn't studied up on abductions. I knew I hadn't bothered with that. So my life was busy. I was a businessman, a sporting personality. I had a lot of stuff going in my mind, and none of it was to do with extraterrestrials, ETs, UFOs, or even interdimensional and other realities, believe me. Furthest thing from my mind. So I was dead. I was in some form of afterlife. That's the only thing I was thinking about. And then I see ghosts in this, other ghosts off in the distance. And because I was trying to figure out, how do you move? You know, here I am, a wisp of cloud, sitting in a suspended area with, you know, out, and this wherever I was at just went out of sight in the distance, but with this pulsing blue light around the outside. And I'm saying, how the hell, if these other entities, these other ghosts, do I move towards them or do I move away from them? And how do I do that anyway? And it came to me in the end that I sort of pushed, like if you push forward with your head, like you want to lean forward to sort of like roll down a hill or something. So I sort of leaned forward, I guess, with my consciousness. And then I found that I could maneuver myself by directing my consciousness forward or sideways or back. And I could actually move. So I was starting to move around in a non-physical form. And that's when, strangely enough, in a non-physical form, so I felt someone like tap me on the shoulder from behind. And I turned around and here's these two, I think maybe one or two, or maybe even three, other ghost-like entities. And there was some sort of communication, and even though it never approached me as a form of communication. It just felt comfortable that I should follow them and that would be okay, because I wasn't in a fearful state. I was quite relaxed. I was just like curious, mostly. But then these ghost-like entities come and tap me on the shoulder and basically say in some form, follow me. And I said, okay, you know, let's go. And we moved out of that ghost-like sort of environment. And as we got, as we moved further on, I started to notice around me there was sort of like technology, like, you know, like earth, like construction stuff, you know, like if you like scaffolding or technology like within an aircraft or something like that, something that looked vaguely familiar, at least it looked like it was constructed and not non-physical. And these ghost-like entities, they suddenly had a form to them. They, you know, an extraterrestrial form. They were very small, human-looking people. And it's sort of you take all this in your stride at the moment. It's like you're on some sort of a trip somewhere, you know. I don't take drugs. I never have. But if you're on a trip in some sort of a drug state, you just accept this stuff as perfectly normal. It's just happening around you and unfolding, and you're just watching it like a spectator. And it's quite, and you know, like I never thought twice about it. I was thought it would turn around and run away. It's just And then they introduced me to this sort of a machine, a glass or metallic sort of a structure that like a tube. And he said, "Step in here, and we'll build a body for you." I said, "Okay." Like I'd done this before, and I'm inside this tube that closes around me. And as I'm looking down, I can see my rib cage forming. I can see the interior of my body forming into a structure. And then next minute, I'm out of this machine, and I have a body. I couldn't see myself. There wasn't a mirror there. But I was told they built the body in the same basic construct as what I had on Earth. So in other words, I had my earthly body or an earthly body look-alike so that I didn't feel completely, disorientated, even though these other creatures, these other extraterrestrials were much smaller than me. They, you know, people have tried to explain to me, that they were greys because, you know, the specific people image what a grey entity looks like, or Zeta Reticuli or whatever you want to call them. These were not greys, but they had a structure of a similar ilk because they were small and slight, about 4 foot tall. There was a hybrid entities there as well, which are semi-human. They were about 5 foot tall, and they looked a lot more like us. But the elder entities were, they had sort of like, I could describe like a leathery skin that was sort of like a million years old. If you could imagine a prune, you know, walking around with legs on it, with a face and a head, but a leathery, wrinkled skin. They were called elders by the hybrids, and they were so ancient, I believe, that they do live for many, many thousands of years, even maybe tens of thousands of years. I have no idea. I couldn't get my head around the extension of their lifespan, but it's massive, maybe even 100,000 years, you know, unimaginable in human form. But evidently, you know, these people were trying to get back to Earth, to live on Earth, that we'll get around to the story of why. But in the meantime, they'd be building, making, or creating a hybrid race, which would be more acceptable on planet Earth and also more functional, because they'd been out of the Earth sort of locale for so long. They were no longer a viable living energy force in the Earth matrix, if you like. So they were had to reconstruct themselves by hybrid splicing of the human genomes into their hybrid selves. Very, very long story.
Yeah.
And I was, in a roundabout sort of way, I was part of this deal, and my time on Earth was to bring back some structure at a soul level, which was immune to this Wi-Fi interference from these grid patterns and the Earth structures and the demonic beings that are trying to lower the Earth life force, if you like, or the human learning curve. They were being basically trying to dumb us down for a very long time, and I had been volunteered, obviously, for a stint on Earth, try and build up some immunity to this interference pattern, so that when we structured our soul matrix, spliced it back into the hybrid entities that they were building, that we would be immune from this. So we could basically come back to Earth and be enlightened beings, if that means anything to you. We wouldn't be dumbed down by the structures that have been put in place on this planet. So there's a big, long story to that, James. I just don't know how much detail. I don't know how much time we've even got on the program. Maybe you can let us know how much time we've got.
We've got about 10 minutes. I had a couple questions for you. One is that you said there was kind of an elder race that you saw. Were they Did they have like hair, and were they, you know, tall robe beans? I was listening to one of your interviews, and I'm just curious what they look like. And you said they created I think her name was something Zeta. I can't remember her name.
Zena. Yeah. I called her Zena. That's not a real name, but I just gave her a name I could pronounce. That's all it is. The elder beings were very small too. They were only about 4 foot tall. Okay. Very slightly built. Yeah, very slightly built. No, they had no hair. They didn't wear any clothes. I mean, well, we had a bodysuit. I mean, when that body was built for me, we were clothed in a bodysuit. And the bodysuit was like a second skin, but I was told it dissolved all in the processes that it did for biological necessities, like it cleared your body waste. And that, like, these people didn't eat food as we would. They didn't eat food at all. They took a nutrient mix of David Hudson's white powder of gold. Since I've been studying up on that when I got back naturally, I did a crash course on all this stuff. Is it real? Can any of this stuff, you know, can it be tracked down into our Earth realities? Well, it can, yes. They were drinking a mixture of certain herbs and plant mix and this white powder of gold in some form that they had concocted. That was their own, and they only drank, you know, like they physically only took this about like once a month or once a week. They had me on a crash course of this when I was on their craft to build up, to get this stuff into my system. So, because their whole technology revolved around this white powder of gold, interdimensional stuff that it is, their craft was built out of it, their bodysuit, this second skin was built out of it, and so you ingested it into your body as well. And so the craft, the structure of the craft, the structure of your consciousness and in your whole body was all at one phase with everything they were doing. Mm-hmm. So that's where the, you know, telepathy, and you didn't have to talk, the mind communication, the consciousness connection with the craft, it came automatically because this high spin state powder of gold is semiconductive at room temperature even. It is a super, it's almost magic, but it's been proven to exist in reality on planet Earth with thanks to David Hudson's work. So this is all real. You know, you can track this stuff down and you can label it. I think science actually calls it exotic material these days. That's their official word for it. That, you know, if anybody was going to admit to magic or alchemy, when you start talking about exotic material, when science calls it that, you know it's out of this world. It is the extreme. It is the future of the human race, I think, James. My hope is that when we start using this stuff, we don't need AI technology to be smart and to be able to communicate. I mean, everyone's buying into AI at the moment. You know, if you can call a cell phone as a form of AI, it's going to be injected into us eventually if the darker powers have their way. And I can see the human race going into slavery because we'll be hacked, we'll be monitored, we'll be controlled on a radio control stick if we go AI way. Mm-hmm. If we take the white powder gold track, I can see enlightenment, and I can see, you know, amazing beings. I can see the human race as it was meant to be structured. And the fact that, you know, in ancient times we did consume this material and it's been taken away from us and hidden from us, it's just part of that dark agenda to dumb down the human race and keep us as robotic, you know, control items. And AI is just going to make that a whole lot easier. And, you know, so my fear is that we go down the AI track and we become slaves for the rest of human history. Because once we get into that zone, we'll never get out again. You know,
I agree. That's one of the things I've been really adamant about is don't go the AI path. Forget about all the hookups and the technology and everything else. It's, you know, that technology is a failure of your spirituality, you know, and it's going to compensate for that. And pretty soon it owns you. You'll be locked into it. But a lot of people look at you funny when you try to warn them about that, and they just don't get it.
No, well, but see, nobody's actually given anyone an alternative, a viable alternative. You know, say, well, you know, you take my cell phone away, you take my computer away, and how am I going to learn anything? How am I going to connect with my friends and that? Well, you know, if you could get the spiritual aspects of white powder of gold and the superconducting capabilities it's got when it's absorbed into the human body, like, you know, There's a TV program on Netflix called Limitless. It's about, you know, guys taking a pill that sparks their brain up to, like, to work at 100% capacity, and everyone's an Einstein that takes that pill. Well, this white powder of gold is very similar, but it's like a tenfold, because, you know, we would connect with the consciousness of the universe, I think, because we'd be self-conducting back to zero point. We'd be in communication with, if you like to use the word, the God of the universe or the intelligence of the universe. Like, every atom's got a story to tell. Every atom's got information stored in it. Like, every rock has got information stored in it. And I think we would be in communication with all of that knowledge that, you know, everything the human race has ever experienced in its whole entire history, we could download personally and privately, or, you know, anyone could do it. And I mean, so who needs the cell phone when you can do that? You know, you can connect with the other side of the universe, you know, thought transfer, and you can go there just as easily too, transport yourself there. So, you know, like, all our technology of cars and planes and cell phones, it's gone. It's chuck it away. It's actually redundant. And it's free and cheap almost, you know, like the pollution of the planet's gone. You know, we're not eating food as we do now. So we don't have to hunt down and kill animals, and we don't have to grow exorbitant amounts of crops. We'd be eating like one thousandth the amount of food that we do at the present time. So the Earth's population could grow in harmony, you know, and we wouldn't be technology destroying, because we wouldn't be using planes and burning fossil fuels and digging up stuff out of the ground. You know, it would be utopia on Earth. And even AI doesn't promise us that. It can't promise us that.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen on the, you know, I went out of body and went into the inner Earth, and I saw these beings, and they weren't totally physical. They're more like in between, and they look similar to some of the beings you're talking about. And they're actually growing this, it was like a fungus or something, and it was about, they're cutting it into cakes. And I asked them what they're doing, and they said that this has everything you need to totally sustain the body, and that's what they're eating. And I was looking at that, and I said, boy, that, you know, if we could get that formula, it would take care of all the problems, you know, on the most of the problems on the planet, you know. And you know, this white powder gold seems like a step up above that as well.
Yeah, well, I'd encourage people to go and hunt down David Hudson's last lecture. He's only given about three in the last 20 years. It's 2011. If you search on YouTube for David Hudson 2011, he's a two-hour talk he gave, and it's full of science. The first hour might be a bit techie and too sciencey for some people. Skip the first hour and listen to the second hour of that David Hudson talk. And he talks about all of the attributes that white powder could give the human race. And I don't think he's talking off the top of his head. I've heard from some very clued up people that says David Hudson's as sharp as a tack. He's not missing anything. He, and you know what nation has taken him on? He spent the last 5 to 10 years pre-2011 in China, and those guys have really taken him, you know, on board. He's been working with the Chinese medical fraternity, and I think he's more than likely been dabbling with the Chinese military into this white powder gold, because it is interdimensional. And it's, you know, unfortunately, I guess, like everything else, it could be weaponized. But by crikey, dicks, it's got the hope of the human race attached to it, and he's just gone with whoever will listen to him and supply the laboratory sort of implements for him to advance his research. I'm certain if you listen to David Hudson's talk, read between the lines, the Chinese have been testing this out on some humans, and of course we're never going to find out too much about what's going on back in there. in that closed workshop. But he came back out into the Western world looking for finance, looking for sponsors to do some research. And now he's gone very, very quiet again. So I would say he's found some backers, and he's gone and he's... because the medical science won't allow people to experiment with this stuff, because when you do a chemical analysis on white powder of gold, it comes out like an aluminium and all sort of negative stuff you don't want to put in your body, but that's only the trace elements off the top. You know, to analyze it, you've got to really go down deep to find out where all this high spin state, you know, rhodium and gold and that material is, which gives you this sort of interdimensional properties of the substance. So, yeah, anybody that wants to really know what I'm talking about, take a good, hard, long listen to David Hudson's talk in 2011. Mm-hmm. And it gives you hope. It really does. It's inspiring to know there's an alternative out there for the human race, and that's what I'm going to be pushing in CoEV 3.
Great. You know, there's... I'm just wondering where you can actually get... There's so many people that supposedly are selling white powdered gold, and I think there's whatever, however they're trying to make it or whatever, they seem to have missed the mark, because, you know, actually,
there is none, James. There's no viable white powder gold on the market. Please let people be warned about that.
Yeah.
It is not available. I mean, David Hudson says it's got to be chelated, and it's got to be, the ancient Egyptians had the formula. If you go back and study some of the works, David Hudson mentions that anyway. That David Hudson interview does talk about the Egyptians using it and it being found there, and the pharaohs were fed on it. And it needs to be almost converted into an absorbable liquid form and chelated so that the human body can recognize it as food. You can't take it as a dry powder or mix it with water, and it just won't work. You know, this is what I say. The scientific production of the stuff is very, very high tech and very expensive. Initially, it's not going to be everywhere. You know, you're not going to be buying it for $3 an ounce. You know, it's going to be like 10 grand an ounce or something, but it's not the point. Like every technology, once it gets out there, and, you know, there'll be people that try to hoard it and try to use it for the wrong purposes. I can see that, as in every human endeavor.
Yeah.
But the ability, it's there, is all I'm saying, James. The light at the end of the tunnel is there, and it just needs a bit more research. And isn't it interesting that for such a fantastic, amazing product, the world is silent. The scientific world is silent on it. And that just doesn't that fit with everything you've ever known about alternative technology?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Hey, unfortunately, we're coming up to the end of the hour. And I don't know if you want people to get in touch with you, if there's a way they can get in touch with you, or just go through Nexus. But if you have any websites or anything you want to give out, this would be a good time.
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Facebook, James, under my own name.
Okay.
And also on Facebook, I have a site called titled CoEvolution, which is dedicated to the new third edition of the book. So, you know, if they go on Facebook and search for CoEvolution or Alec Newell, they'll find me, and then I can guide them to CoEvolution. And they can, if they want to talk to me, they can talk to me on Facebook. I'm open to any discussions about this stuff freely. You know, I'm not hiding anything, and I'm not trying to hide from the world. So there you go.
Awesome. Well, it's been awesome connecting and talking with you. I know we can probably do a couple more shows because we just touched the tip of the iceberg, but we'll have to get you back on real soon.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we didn't talk about the 10 days away, and that's about 3 hours on its own. Well, you know, obviously we can go there now that people have got a bit of a base to key off. I really appreciate the time to talk, James. I appreciate your efforts and your time you've taken for this stuff.
Oh, anytime. And thank you for all the efforts that you've gone to and for going public and bringing this information out.
You're welcome.
All right. All right. We're out of time, unfortunately, folks. All I can say is stay in the heart, watch the skies, and might want to start looking into this white powder gold and see what we can come up with. Anyway, have a great evening. This is James Gillen with As You Wish Talk Radio. signing off.